Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, Internet Radio. You are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Amanda Dell.
I'm Kimberly Chow.
We are the co-hosts of Recommended Reading here on Heritage Radio Network and the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a festival of writing about eating.
We do the festival and events around the calendar year in New York City, in Los Angeles, and we broadcast the show out of the back of beautiful Roberta's Pizza, headquartered Heritage Radio Network in sunny Bushwick, Brooklyn. Yeah. We are thrilled to be on the show today with Daniel Isenkart. He is a cabaret performer, a longtime chef, caterer, a man of many stories and words, and he'll be talking about his book, The Art of Gay Cooking, which is a play on Alice B. Toklas's cookbook, something we really love, and he's got a lot of recommends of reading, watching, and listening. So we'll bring him on in a little bit.
Cool. And just some quick housekeeping regarding Food Book Fair. If you are in the New York area this coming Saturday, we are hosting a book signing at the Union Square Green Market, as we do many Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. And we'll be hosting under our tent, Jeremiah.
Jeremiah Stone
and Fabian von Hausk. They are the authors of a very serious cookbook. They're the chef owners of Contra and Wild Air. So they'll be hanging with us under the tent in Union Square this coming Saturday from 10 to 12. So come visit us.
Amanda, what are you reading, watching, or listening to?
Thanks, Kim. hopefully we can be more, hopefully this answer will excite you a little bit. I've been reading, watching, or listening to a bunch of things, but I just got back from a trip and I forced all of the people that I was listening to in the car to listen to podcasts that I've already recommended on this show.
What is it?
Well, we listened to Still Processing.
Amazing.
We listened to this other podcast, which I think I talked about, Up and Vanished, about vanishing people.
Okay.
It's scary, but good. We listened to How I Built This.
Okay.
So my favorite episode with Barbara Corcoran.
Okay.
So I had to shift a little and I'll find something new. But I was just listening to those on a long car ride.
Where were you driving to and from?
I was driving to and from Maine. I had the pleasure of attending a beautiful wedding, and my friend and driver for the weekend was Marissa Lippert of Nourish Kitchen and Table. So I had to come up with good entertainment along the way. And also we got to eat in Portland, which was really great. I had never been there before, and we had a pretty aggressive agenda, but we crossed most things off our list.
Yeah, if you guys follow at Amanda underscore Dell, you saw she was doing the most. It's like, did you ever make it to this wedding? Are you just journeying around Maine?
We did make it. It was great. But yes, I tried to do a lot. So it was really fun, but didn't leave any time for reading. So I had to read a little bit as soon as I got back. And I try to, you know, my always favorite that I have open is New York Magazine and all of their verticals. So I'm always, you know, checking out Grub Street. But sometimes I have to cruise over to Eater and see what they're writing about. And one article I just read it when I first woke up this morning, and I couldn't stop thinking about it in the shower.
Tell us more.
It's written by Stephanie Tudor. The subject line is Why Momofuku's Billionaire Investor is Aggressively Funding NYC's Top Restaurants. It basically was about this one particular gentleman, Stephen Ross, and his... I mean, I guess you could call it, it's not really a venture capital fund. It's just his fund that invests in startups. It's called RSE Ventures. And basically the article talked about how RSE Ventures has recently shifted from investing in things like SoulCycle or something that we've discussed on this show, Lola, the tampon delivery service. why they have started to invest in places like Momofuku, in the Australian coffee import Bluestone Lane, in Milk Bar. And the long story short of the article is they're basically investing in these to as most investments, you know, you hope will do, to bring money back, you know, to their fund again by really integrating many of these type of, they're not fast casual, but they're not exactly really fine dining restaurants, to bring them back to some of the other places that they own. Like this gentleman is involved, you know, owns a sports team. So they want to have all of these food concepts in stadiums. He's also a huge real estate developer. I think that's pretty much how he made his money. So he wants to then, you know, integrate these businesses in real estate properties that he's developing. So it just got me thinking, you know, why are certain food concepts successful? Why do people know about them? How and who is selecting the businesses that get funded? And how is this cycle either broken or how is it working? You know, I think Christina Tosi is really talented, and I think her business has a very specific point of view, and I think it really appeals to people. But what is it about her business that made this huge fund want to invest in her? And now it's becoming a national name because they're able to roll out, you know, shipping nationwide. Mm-hmm. So again, it's kind of just had me, it has me thinking about the restaurant world. It had me thinking about New York specifically, even though many of these properties are, you know, and these concepts, their expansion plan is national, if not international. Mm. And just people who don't have a background in restaurants or culinary or chefs or, you know, anything close to that are now making the decisions about what restaurants and what cafes or, you know, what businesses are moved forward.
Yeah.
So I just, I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. I don't want to come out and say like, this is all bad. It's all good. It just really is still stuck, you know, in my mind as kind of lifting that this article to a small degree lifted the veil as to why certain businesses have become almost ubiquitous. Like,
you're like,
in New
why
York.
Do you see Bluestone right. Lane everywhere?
Exactly. You're like, oh, now I get it. And it's just, you know, a lot of the things that we talk about a lot, having access to resources, not only to, you know, cold hard cash, but when you're part of a larger, you know, investment plan, you have the resources like human resources, like, you know, lawyers, like people to help you get through the red tape of opening in New York. All of these things that, of course, are worth money, but are part of investing with someone, you know, like this huge investment company, RSC Ventures.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
hard numbers for your Monday as a Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, I just want to, you know, think about it a little bit more. And also my first inclination always goes to like, is this person funding women-owned businesses?
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, yes. So, you know, I want to do a little more research and I want to, you know, talk to a few more people before I really like make any decision about how I truly feel about it.
I mean, he's not the only person doing this.
No. And the article mentions that. It's just, you know, I think we have this like romantic idea in a way, or maybe I did, and that was crushed a little bit more of like, wow, you know, this person has an incredible product. We, you know, they grew up baking with their family. We want to spread, you know, sure, that throughout the country. And it's like, kind of like, well, actually someone saw it and like wanted to put it in their stadium. So that's why they gave them money. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to discount anyone's hard work because I know so well how hard it is, even with all the, you know, with money and resources, how hard it is to open a business,
mm-hmm,
you know, so credit to all of the, you know, the people that are doing that.
Yeah. But obviously it's a lot easier when you have certain kinds of institutional support or corporate support.
Right. So.
But I mean, there have been folks that have no experience in specific industries that have money, that have been sinking it into industries in which they're not expert for millennia. I mean, before money existed as, you know.
Yeah. And that's kind of been a strategy in some ways. Like, certain businesses are like, well, maybe we don't want to bring a food person in. We want to bring a business person in, or we want to bring, you know, a strategist in that's never worked in that field so that they can bring their expertise to the table and not maybe get caught up in the ins and outs of the business, but present a strategy in a refreshing way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think it's like you're a restaurant person. Or your background is as a restaurant person. And I've also been a restaurant person on and off. And we always talk about, does this kill the romance?
Right.
Yeah, it does. But we live in a corporate shit stem. So are we all just trying to, can we all just live?
Right. I guess I'm just reacting to anything that I really do feel like kills the romance, even though I should know better at this point.
No, I mean, like, I don't think just because you know that most the romance is dead in most parts of the world or in most ways of living and systems of operating doesn't mean that you can't savor it. Still. And along those lines, I'm reading this book called How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood by Peter Moskowitz, which is out from Nation Books. It just came out in paperback, came out last year, though. And in it, they talk about San Francisco, New Orleans, Detroit, and New York City as different examples of how gentrification has flourished or how it sort of... how gentrifiers live and the investment that is going into the neighborhoods in which they live are sort of dictating how cities are built or organized. I mean, gentrifiers themselves, people that love the beet lattes or the golden milk lattes at Bluestone Lane aren't necessarily gentrifying the neighborhood.
I didn't know you were going to go to latte. I was like, people love the beats, like beat latte. Like music.
I'm trying to stick with your example.
Right.
But, you know, they go into specifically in New York City. I mean, in all of the examples, but I've read the Detroit chapter, which is where I'm from, and the New York City chapter, which is where we live, and specifically about how it's all tied into years and years of lawmaking combined with corporate interests, combined with
tourism. It's something we spoke about with Jeremiah's book, Vanishing New York.
So Daniel and I were talking about it just a little bit, and he asked if I had read Vanishing New York.
Oh, okay.
By Jeremiah Moss, which is one of Amanda's all-time recommends, I have to say.
Top of my list right now.
And I would love to then kick it over to him. Welcome to the show.
Daniel!
Thank you so much for having me.
Sorry, that was a long-winded recommend from Kim and I.
I was fascinated listening to you. I really like also what you said about the article. I think the question really is about access to resources and who really are the middlemen who introduce investors to the talent. And I think there's a lot to be said about that because I think it's probably very cliquish And it really comes down to having connections. And I think that investors are much more likely to invest in someone that already has been moved up the echelon, mm-hmm. rather than really venturing into discovering someone on their own because they don't have the time. So I think that that's why we see sort of a clique, and people who already had a certain presence then lifted even further up.
Right.
And then the numbers become smaller and smaller. Obviously, the further you go up the pyramids, that's just part of the geometry.
Right. It's like almost a double-edged sword. It's
it
like
is
you
part
have
of the
to,
geometry.
Right. You have to become, you know, popular enough, but not too popular for then someone to invest, you know.
Yeah, but you also have to know how to play the game, obviously. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the Faustian deal recently. So
which one? Sorry.
The Faustian deal. So the deal with the devil, basically.
Right. Okay, Faustian. Got it.
Where you basically renounce love. And I think that maybe it's time to rethink that narrative, because the narrative is always presented as saying, oh, we have to now feel sympathy for the person who made the deal with the devil because that poor person doesn't have love in his or her life. Okay. But I think actually what it means is that you are letting go love in order to be as ruthless as your business asks you to be in order to move up, and it's the rest of the world that suffers for it because love is no longer part of your operational mode. And I think how I look at it right now.
Okay.
Anyway,
that makes me think of something that your partner, Philip Notre Dame, says about you and your book in a great New York Times piece about the art of gay cooking, where he talks about love and generosity as being part of your worldview and about the work that you do and how there's nothing more queer than that in our world that is dictated by ego.
Yeah, in the end, it comes down to your values. It really comes down to what do you want out of this life. And if you just want to make lots of money, that's fine. Money is related to power. If you want to have a lot of power, that is related to that. And I don't think that sits well with my personality. I'd like to do things on a more intimate scale and on a human level. So as a cabaret performer, I have performed in intimate spaces. As a chef, I do small dinner parties. I wrote a book that is really, very much a niche, even though I'm trying to make a point with it. I have this book, The Art of Gay Cooking, which is an adaptation of the Alice B. Toklas cookbook that transposes her story to the present. So the Alice B. Toklas cookbook, for those of your listeners who don't know it, it's really about the life of an American lesbian couple of expats who lived in Paris in the early 20th century. And Alice B. Toklas was the caretaker of the household, and Gertrude Stein was a designated genius and writer.
Designated genius.
Yeah.
I like that line.
And so as it was officially declared.
Goals.
Yeah. So, but there was a very clear hierarchy, although how it in the end really worked inside, we never know. And actually, you can never know this about any relationship.
Right.
You never know what's really happening, but this is how they presented it. And then, so Gertrude Stein wrote the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas about their lives, and she devised a ruse that pretended that the book had been written by Alice, but she was really the author. So it was a chance to write about herself as the genius. And the reveal did not come until the end of the book. So, American lesbian expat living in Paris, part of the bohemian world, friends with Picasso and Matisse. And Philip, my partner, he took that book and translated it and to tell our story, and there were a lot of parallels. So we are two European gay men living in New York, and we're part of the art world, so that was that. And then when I decided a few years later, that book came out in 2014, that I wanted to write a cookbook, he said, well, you should do the same thing with the Alice B. Toklas cookbook, because Alice B. wrote the famous Alice B. Toklas cookbook. So my book is really a translation of that, and it was an act of conceptual writing, very creative in its own way, because it was very queer to approach writing this way, because I went paragraph by paragraph, transforming each of her stories into one of mine, keeping her syntax. But in the end, as you said, it's really all about love. So the book celebrates the intimacy that can come through food, and how food brings everyone together, and how the most important ingredient in cooking really is love. But if you, of course, you know, if you are a big business, then you have a whole different set of things you need to take care of. And of course, every chef will say, yes, I put my love into it. But if you have to operate on a certain level, you know, I don't know how much of that, you know, can be put into it, into the food. You know, that's really the challenge in the end, because you have to go home at the end of the day and feel that you have applied yourself to the job with your entire human being. And how much does an industry allow you to do that? That's really also the question. So for me, the solution was, well, I keep things small. It suits me. I cook for families. I do intimate dinner parties. I gladly say no when I'm offered a bigger job. And I love to write. And my life is about performing and cooking. And in a way, those two worlds intersect in the kitchen anyway. I think cooking is very performative.
Definitely. Well, we're looking forward to getting into that a little bit more and talking about the book, the process, your life. But it wouldn't be recommended reading without a couple recommends. I know you came prepared. For listeners out there, Daniel's lap is filled to the brim with books and notes and filled with post-its.
Yes.
So we can't wait to dive in. So what have you been reading, watching, or listening to?
All right. So this past weekend was a wonderful example on how my different worlds collide. I was cooking in the Hamptons for a family.
Okay.
And as I was preparing lunch, I knew that there would be online a live broadcast of an opera production of Tosca from Helsinki, directed by a very dear friend of mine, Christoph Loy. And I've been eager to see it, obviously, because I love his work and I love opera. It's very much part of my life now. So it started as I was serving lunch, so I was rushing back and forth between the kitchen and the dining room trying to catch glimpses of the first act and trying to speed things up so I could watch the end of the production, which I did, and I encourage everyone to watch it. It's a genius production. The director is really doing very specific, detailed work with the singers. This is opera as grand, great theater, not just as a visual spectacle, even though the music is, of course, glorious. So that is listening / watching. I don't have television, I don't go to the movie theaters, but I love to go to the opera and to theater, and this was sort of a mix between the two as I was locked into the kitchen or my little maid's chamber, as I call it, leaning against the wall and crying my heart out because, you know, of watching this great production and listening to it. And in terms of books, when I'm in New York, I'm in New York 10 months of the year. Then there are 2 months where I spent in France. In France, I have more time on an island. That's where I like to write and read fiction. But in New York, where life is much more fragmented, I am more tending towards nonfiction.
Okay.
And there are many different fields of interest. So right now I found, or rather Philip found for me, a wonderful cookbook from the 80s. It's the Golden Fitzdale Cookbook, Food for Good Living, by Arthur Gold and Robert Fitzdale. And they were a gay couple of classical concert pianists who performed as a duo and loved cooking and became eventually the food columnists for Vogue magazine. And go ahead.
When I was doing some research, that's one of the books that came up.
Oh,
like
wonderful.
If I Googled like The Art of Gay Cooking or
I wish I had known, because when I did my research to write Queering the Kitchen, which is the other book that I came out with this August, I was not aware of it. But here you have actually someone who really lived the art of gay cooking, because what for me, what that is that food is so much part of an organic part of your life. And they are artists, obviously. So there's a mix where, you know, the reality of life and just going through the tasks, the daily things of just making food and approaching everything with an artistic spirit blends together. And you're elevating everything to a certain art form, but you also add, and I think that is really the queer element, a playfulness. You don't need to follow the rules. You allow yourself to be spontaneous. You're not orthodox about it. And that's where the fun comes in. And I always try to tell people, when you cook, you have to become a child. You have to play. It's really to just follow recipes, then you will just learn how to follow a recipe. You do not learn how to cook by doing that. And I teach adults how to cook who have not done this all their life. And that's my first point. You have to become a child again. You have to. Yeah.
For folks that are listening, you can check out at Food Book Fair, the Instagram story we just posted of the cover of this book by Golden Fitzdale. It is the two of them sitting in front of a grand piano, and there is a fish on a platter. There are tomatoes. There's like a stalk of Brussels sprouts. There's a bunch of other vegetables in the piano.
In the piano. Music in the kitchen. See, that's really a wonderful theme of mine, and actually the name of a chapter in my book, Now, Alice B. Toklas is in her book called that chapter Murder in the Kitchen. Mm. And she has a very wry sense of humor. You know it, of course. She has to kill the carp. And so at that time when she wrote it, of course, you really sometimes had to bring live animals home and deal with it. So I had to transform this into something that occurs in my life. And for me, that became music in the kitchen and writing about how cooking is performing and how I balanced being a private chef with being a cabaret performer. And how those things have certain similarities. Mm. And how if you have a sense of musicality and an approach to the art of music and performance, how you can infuse your food with that. It really, there's a certain melodiousness to this. And, you know, in the end, it becomes about color and texture and contrast and a certain drama without being overly dramatic about it, because that's a bore.
Okay, what are the other two books?
Yeah.
Okay, what else do
I have? Oh, you got a few books.
No, yeah. Well, I have, because
this
I have a course of my
own. This is a very perambulatory, non-linear show.
Not a problem at all. So I am also reading a book by Keith Johnstone. It's called Impro, and that is a book for actors, actually a book that would be useful for anyone, about improvisational skills. And I'm reading that right now as I'm preparing a masterclass that I'm teaching in Montreal later this month, where I'll be working with circus artists on how to use their voice to eventually work as an MC in a cabaret setting.
Wow.
So that's another part of my life. And the irony, of course, is that these are people who have mastered the physicality of their presence on stage and don't use their voice. But usually I work with opera singers and teach them body language and stage presence because they only focus on the voice. And I want to work on them on how to create a physical aura that is on the same artistic level as their vocal output. Mm. So that's the other part of
my
life.
Sign me up. When I need
anytime.
To work on. I want to work on my aura with you.
Absolutely, but my pleasure. But you have a beautiful aura.
Yeah,
there's a certain relaxedness about you, so I don't
think
you need
nice.
A lot of work
That's
at
why,
all.
Thank you. That's why this is a good. It's good that we have a radio show.
Absolutely.
Can't see the aura. Hope you can hear it.
And then I can say, well, in terms of fiction, but that book is not coming out in English until next year, by pretty much the top best-selling German language author right now, Daniel Kehlmann. He wrote a book about Till Eulenspiegel, who was a fool, a famous fool in the medieval ages in Europe, very famous for his pranks and very much a philosopher at the same time. And he put that book into the context of the 30-year war that ravaged Central Europe during that era. And so that's a book of fiction, and it's fantastic. And I can't wait for the translation to come out because I'd like to read it in both versions. Yeah, and of course I read Edna Lewis, At the Table with an American Original. I bought the book when I went to visit Food Book Fair.
At Union Square Green Market.
Sarah and me, we were on a panel together at the Brooklyn Book Fest a few days later. But I loved that book so much because I thought it was a very elegant solution that Sarah came up with to let different voices speak about Miss Lewis and to really show that sometimes they would even contradict one another. And I think that is so important that we have really a wide range of perspectives that sometimes overlap and sometimes don't agree. This is how you create a much more complete image of, yes, a real original with all her complexities as Miss Lewis was. And it was a great eye-opener. I knew of her, but this was really the next level. Great book.
Awesome.
We love it too.
Yeah. We're just going to take a short break and then we will return with Daniel Isengard and get even to talking about even more and more. You've surprised me already so much.
Thank you.
We're going to work on our auras. But in the meantime, for folks listening, we are a show on Heritage Radio Network. It is a nonprofit, member-supported radio network that produces the show as well as 30 other ones all about the worlds of food and drink and the things that intersect with them. Please support us and others and keep us on air by going to heritageradionetwork.org and becoming a member today.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hello, this is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Kimberly Chow.
I'm Amanda Dell, and we are back in the studio for anyone just tuning in with Daniel Isengard. He is an Hello. Author, a chef. He's an aura consultant. I know there's more to it than that.
Yes, I keep on expanding my capacities as much as I can.
Yeah, his latest book, Queering the Kitchen, A Manifesto, came out this year. So officially welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
Wonderful being here. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
We're talking to him about that book. We're talking to him about The Art of Gay Cooking, which is a title of his that is modeled after Alice B. Toklas's famous cookbook and literary artwork. And we'll get more into that. But we were just talking a little bit about recommends and readings, and it's been a wonderful, rambling, nonlinear show thus far.
I apologize for that.
No apologies at all. No apologies at all. But I just wanted to quote a little bit from a piece about you that our friend Lucas Volger, our mutual friend, wrote in Jari. And when it says, "When I cook," says Daniel Isengard, "it's performance." The writer, cabaret artist, and chef has donned a high-collared Edwardian shirt and tied a cluster of metallic bulbs and beads around his neck to serve as a tie. So imagine that for folks that are listening to the radio. Standing behind the kitchen island that faces his dining table, his stage, his audience, with a smattering of fruit, vegetables, and other ingredients before him, his cast, his props, he looks directly into the camera as we begin taking photos. Stern, but amused, laser sharp. It's Marlena Dietrich or Johnny Weir. Meanwhile, Liza Minnelli belts from the CD player. So that's a little bit of stage setting.
Pretty good combo. Nicely written. Thank you, Lucas.
Yeah. Can you talk to us more about that, about cooking and performance? We started off the conversation about that.
Well, when I started to work as a private chef, it was in an open kitchen in the Hamptons. So a lot of chefs are, I think, not very comfortable with having someone really watch what they do all the time or interact with them. For me, that's perfectly natural, has always been. So I'm pretty good at multitasking. And I'm also, you know, a big talker, obviously. So I would have people in the kitchen. You know how it is in a big house. People always hang out in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And they have conversations. And then they watch what you do. And they find it fascinating. It's basically, it's a live cooking show they can witness while they're being in the Hamptons. And so there was a lot of interaction and questions. And I'm very happy to talk while I do this. And obviously, you have to have a certain level of skills to keep things neat and clean and being well organized so you don't get frazzled. But somehow my mother instilled that in me, so that was fine. And it's not that I'm trying to do a show, you know, juggling with knives or something like that. But I think that when you're on a certain level, you work with speed, you work with a certain proficiency. There's a fluidity to your moves that really can be like a dance. A lot of chefs really move like dancers, even if they don't have dancers' bodies. I think, you know, there's a grace to them, which I find beautiful to watch. And how you interact and playfully interact with people and make fun of what you do at the same time, or you explain to them what they do. I mean, I have kids to come into the kitchen with me, and they always want to get involved, and I love that. And I always get them involved as much as possible if time allows. I had a little 9-year-old who was chopping carrots, and, you know, some parents might be horrified of giving a big knife to a kid like that, but I think we need to encourage kids to get involved and get in there as early as possible and let them be part of the whole thing. So there's that as well. In terms of performance for cooking, I mean, that, of course, you know, when Lucas came, I, of course, set it up. You know, it was a photo shoot. It's not like I'm always wearing my cabaret outfit in the kitchen.
I thought you always wore, like, an extravagant necklace anytime you were
prepping. A scarf sometimes will have to do. But I definitely, as you can tell, I'm wearing one right now. I'm a scarf person. That's sort of a wink to the opera world, maybe. All singers always wear scarves. and Parisians, I hear from David Leibovitz's book. That's another wonderful book, by the way.
Yes.
La Part.
I just finished
reading it. Ooh. It was very amusing. I didn't even expect that. It was a lot of fun. Obviously, his recipes are great, but he has a great sense of humor, and that's a fun read. La Part by David Leibovitz.
Cool.
And he mentions that Parisians always
wear
scarves. Yeah, mm-hmm. So I thought, I grew up in Paris, so maybe it rubbed off even early on. So.
Perfect. So I wanted to talk to you about that a little bit. You were born in Germany.
Yes.
And then grew up in Paris?
Uh-huh.
So
my preteens basically were spent in Paris, and then we moved back to Munich, where I went to high school, and then I went to the Academy of Fine Arts to go into interior design, and then skipped all that and said, no, I can't. I have to work in something that's more sensual. And went into the performing arts and moved to New York in 92.
Okay, two questions from that. Oh, it's an excellent, excellent brief biography of your earlier years. Was there something in your childhood that made you become interested in cooking? One, and how did you grow up? And you know, what role did food and dining play in your formative years? And then what eventually brought you to New York? And you mentioned, you spend time in France as well, but really made New York your home.
Yeah. So cooking, I was always fascinated with cooking. I always hung out in the kitchen. And that is something I actually address in Queering the Kitchen. I make the case that maybe a certain type of gay man gravitates towards cooking because we spend time at home with our mothers and grandmothers because we don't go out to play soccer with the boys. And in my world, definitely, my mother and grandmothers were cooking. My mother was working, but she loved to cook, and it was very much part of our lives that we always ate homemade food together as a family. And both my grandmothers were great cooks, especially really my father's mother. From her, I learned how to be relaxed in the kitchen because she had a certain natural ease. That was maybe the most important thing I could really look up to as a kid, and she cooked big meals for a big extended family get-togethers, but always, she was always relaxed in the kitchen. And as a kid, obviously, I wanted to get involved, and I started with baking cookies. That's, I love sugar, obviously, so that's how I got started. And then I became more and more involved and became a little opinionated brat, which means that everybody in the family then started to say, oh, we can't cook for you anymore because you're too opinionated. And that now happens sometimes here with friends, and I always say, no, you don't understand. Actually, people who cook are very generous when they receive something cooked by somebody else. There's this notion that we're too critical, and no, I think we really know how to put that aside, and I think that we're very gracious as guests. I would hope so. If not, then you really need to fix that, because you should not impose your own standards on somebody else. You should be graciously accepting the generosity when somebody is willing to cook for you, which is a very intimate thing to do. Cooking always part of my life.
And I didn't
go to culinary school, never went. Okay. I've always cooked all my life. And when I quit the interior decorating arts, interior architecture, I went to dance school. And then obviously I came to America because of show business.
Okay.
And I came as a dance student, but always knew I wanted to do cabaret. Here we come back to Liza Minnelli, of course. She's my big idol, and I think still one of the greatest performers alive today. And I started doing cabaret, and as many dance students and performers in New York City, I worked as a waiter, and then I got into the catering industry, and always watched very keenly what the chefs were doing. Many of them were French. I spoke French with them, and always very interested how the organizational skills of pulling off these huge gala dinners and all that, how I learned a lot from watching them. And then I got this serendipitous offer to basically become the houseboy in the Hamptons villa. And I was not interested in the least to do that. But I inquired, well, who is going to do the cooking?
Right.
And they said, we're just going to pick up. I mean, basically, your job will be to pick up prepared food somewhere and put it out on nice platters. And I said, I think I can do better. Let me do the cooking. So I turned the whole thing around and I took over the kitchen. And that's how I started.
Wow.
And this was in 96.
Are those people still your clients?
Yes, they are.
Wow.
I mean, I don't.
It's going above and beyond scope of work.
Well, I've only cooked full time for 2 years for one couple, but it works much better for me to freelance and have several clients that use me sporadically because I do so many other things. I started to direct opera. I'm doing Carmen in Canada in January, so I need that freedom, that independence.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Wow. That's incredible. What? One last question in this area was there one restaurant or one experience with one chef that really like allowed you to lift the veil even more, or some anyone that was, what was your best, you know, or worst, or any, you know,
sure,
experience of a restaurant in New York?
When I started out, I really did not have the means to go out and eat a lot.
Right.
I just didn't. And I really also, at that time, this was the mid-90s, the food world in New York was really not what it is today at all. I'm sure there were great places, there's no question about that, but I did not really seek that out. My inspiration came from the markets.
Okay.
So I really explored all over New York City, the different places. And also, to be fair, this was sort of the early days of the Food Network, so there were some cooking shows that were fun to watch. When I had to cook every day for these 2 years for one couple, you know, you wake up in the morning, and since if you work for the same people every day, my point was I want to do something very different every day. So in the morning,
what
you said, okay, what am I going to do today? It has to be really different from yesterday's. So I grabbed a few inspirations here and there. I will say, though, that when I first went to Gabrielle Hamilton's Prune, also around that time, it was briefly after she opened, and I know Gabrielle and I adore what she does, her food, but I sat down and I thought, what this food does to me, I think is somewhat similar to what my food does to others. So it was somewhat close. I felt, I recognize this somehow. So that was a very interesting, that never happened again.
Okay.
That never happened again. And I have to honestly say, as much as I think it's great that we have this vibrant restaurant scene, that is not part of my life. I really entertain at home. We have dinner parties all the time. And I cook for Philip. Philip loves to eat, and he loves to eat at home. So we don't really dine out a lot. And when we do, we tend to go back to the same places again and again. I love Rebecca Charles, Pearl Oyster Bar on Cornelia Street. That is a staple I will always be happy to go back to. I love to have meetings at Buvette, which is, I think, a perfect bistro. And I took my friend Jeremiah Tower there, and he approved. So it has an official stamp of approval from the master.
Wow. Jeremiah. I love the intro to your book.
Yes, he wrote very generously a beautiful intro.
Yeah.
Well, I met him after the premiere of Anthony Bourdain's documentary, The Last Magnificent. And in the film, he talks about the Alice B. Toklas cookbook being a major influence in his life. And that's, I had already finished the manuscript for my book at the time, and I said, I have to meet him because he will totally understand what I was trying to do, which was really an unusual approach to writing a cookbook. Yeah. And I sent it to him, and we became friends.
I thought that film was really, really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you fall in love with him. He's just such a wonderful man.
Yeah.
Very special. I told him, I stood up at the Q&A, and I said, I would like to state that the film shows very beautifully and clearly that you are a genius and that you're an artist, but I would like to add something. I would like to add that you are a noble man, and that's very rare. And I really do believe that he's above most of the rest, because he's in a complete different zone, and he's an artist. Many chefs are artists, but he has also the pedigree of the past. He links the 19th century and the 20th century, and he's still active now. Good for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super cool. I think a lot of people are very intimidated by the idea of having people over in their home for dinner and cooking for people and having a dinner party. And I think, as you know, someone like yourself who does it all the time, and you know, Kim and I have people over, and we do that in our own homes. And I think we've had I'll speak for myself. I've had success, and I've had things that were not that successful. But I still do it all the time, and
I'm sure
love
you're too
it.
Critical of yourself. I'm sure your guests would beg to differ. I trust. I'm really.
Thank you. That's very kind. I love it. I wish I always want to do it more. But maybe how can, for someone that's a little bit apprehensive or scared, or you know, what's something, just some encouragement, a simple menu, like say to someone, maybe just start with like a Saturday lunch or something. Like what's your starter kit?
Sure. So, I should say that this is something that I have addressed in the food column that I'm writing now on slates.com.
Excellent entry for it.
Thank you. Well, you just handed it to me, but I have to mention that, of course. Okay. I've been doing this since July. On slates.com, the column is called The Pickle.
I love that.
The idea being that when you're in a pickle, you can write to us.
Ah.
And you send in questions to slatepickle@gmail.com. And I get to answer 3 questions per week. So all your listeners, please send me interesting questions. There's a lot about home entertaining.
Okay.
So I do understand that people are somewhat apprehensive. I first applaud when people are willing to do this. And I always say, go for it, but make it easy on yourself. Because in the end, it's really about the energy and the love that you're sharing and the conversation and the welcoming atmosphere that you're creating. So it's not really so much about the food. This is not the moment to show off. I actually had a question about a couple who said, we are often invited to a dinner party by this couple of bankers who are serious foodies, and they make this very elaborate meal every time, very expensive. We feel a little bit shy because we can only afford to bring an affordable bottle of wine that doesn't really go with it, and we have to compliment them all the time. So, and then they don't let us invite them back to our house. So we're a little bit miffed about this friendship and start to question it. And I wrote to them basically, yes, you should, because you are not the head, you know, the guinea pigs to just come in there and just let them enjoy their high status of being great chefs. That's not the idea of entertaining at home. So you have to know yourself.
Right.
You have to be realistic. This is not the moment to experiment if you're not used to that. So keep it simple. I would say lunch is tricky because lunch means you have to get up early. I don't like to do lunch really. I think you should give yourself the time of the day if you can do that, so you can work at your own ease and at your own pace. It's very important to be really ready when the guests arrive.
Okay, that's great advice.
That's one thing. You keep it, you know, keep it neat and clean. You don't want to, you know how it is when you come somewhere and the host is frazzled and they're not really ready and they're frantically trying to hide in the kitchen. Or that doesn't work. That's already a bad setup.
Okay.
So you need to be relaxed. You need to relax and keep things simple. And I don't mind, you know, in the end, if you make an easy, nice pasta dish, even for a small group, everybody will appreciate that. Just, you know, a few little details to show that this is your own. You add your own stamp to it. This is what you like. I had another question by someone who says, my family, they're all very picky with food and they have all these different requests and I'm bored by making this bland food for family events. And my answer was, no, you don't let your family describe what you cook for them. This is your home. You're making a statement. You have to be gracious and generous. You don't cook things that they really clearly dislike or obviously are allergic to, but this is also not
poison.
This is really your point of saying, this is me, and I welcome you in my home, and there are maybe alternatives if you don't want to eat that, but this is how I like to do things. Welcome to my home. You don't let other people hijack you. You have to be generous, but anyway, so keep it simple. Keep it simple and try to keep your time in the kitchen at a minimum while your guests are there. So prepare as much as possible. I think people don't mind the room temperature meal, so everything can already be set out. You can do it buffet style.
I almost exclusively serve room temperature meals.
Good for you. Smart. Yes. Because you
10% hot, 90%
you cannot disappear in the kitchen and leave your guests alone awkward. And if you do that, and if you have a partner, then you have to collaborate. Your partner needs to entertain the guests while you're gone.
Big time.
So it's really also about a collaboration. If you don't live alone and if you have a partner, you have to be very clear who takes care of the drinks, who introduces guests to one another. Very important that many people don't understand how important the role of the host is in introducing guests to one another and pointing out what they may have in common to get a conversation started. That's all the art of entertaining. Actually, Jeremiah Tower, we just mentioned it, he wrote a book on etiquette in the 21st century, which is a beautiful little booklet where he talks about that as well.
And it's illustrated by Libby Vanderplug.
Yes.
Beautifully.
Oh,
beautiful.
Wow.
Thank you. Illustrator. Of course you know about
that.
It.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been extremely informative on so many levels.
Thank you.
I very much am going to take what you said to heart about the introductions, the splitting up the duties, because I could improve on that. So it's something important to think
on. It will make it easier
on.
For you. That's really the key. And then that will rub off on your guests.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe one day we'll have the pleasure of hosting you in either Kim or my home.
The pleasure would be all mine to host you as well. Thank
that
you.
Sounds cool. Wonderful. In the meantime, for folks that want to find out more about Daniel and his work, you can check out his books, Queering the Kitchen, A Manifesto, and The Art of Gay Cooking, both out through Outpost 19, as well as the autobiography of Daniel J. Isengard.
Thank you.
By his partner, Philip Notre Dame. You can also find him at The Pickle, the new Slate column.
Right,
you can ask more questions like this to slatepickle@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
Oh, good. Thanks for joining us.
See you at the dinner table soon, we hope.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking, and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.